This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station, 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 15th of February. I'm Melissa Idris with Kusu Chuang here this morning.
Good morning.
Do you know, I just realized today is my 6th anniversary with BFM.
Is that
it
right?
It is,
wow.
Yeah.
Today, goodness gracious.
Of all days. I came into work this morning, I was like, why is this date significant? And I realized, oh, it's the anticlimactic day after Valentine's Day, but also an anniversary with BFM.
Is that right? Wow, you've been here two-thirds of the company's existence, actually.
Two-thirds, yeah, that's right.
Roughly.
This is the ninth year that BFM is in operation. But I hope you stay with us this morning, because today on The Breakfast Grill, a special one. Tan Sri Sharir Samad, chairman of Felda, will be joining us to talk about the recent controversies surrounding Felda. In fact, he just joined in January, and when he was appointed chairman, he made this famous quote to say that there will be blood on the streets once he takes over Felda's chairmanship.
Ayo, why do they have to go and say things like that?
But well, he said he wanted a total revamp of Felda and Felda's management.
Yeah, that's right. So, okay, a little bit of background. Felda was set up in, I think, 1956 under some archaic legislation, and they're basically meant to alleviate the poverty of the rural folk via, you know, planting oil palm and, I think, rubber trees in those days. But it's since morphed into a very, very different organization, because I think in 2004, the government withdrew its financial support for Felda, and it's had to do a few things, such as going to create its own commercial entities to make a buck. Mm-hmm. So it created FIC, which is the investment corporation. It's had a cooperative Felda, and it's also got FGV, of which I think it owns about 20-odd% and is the biggest single shareholder of it. The only thing is, since then, it's kind of like lost its way a little bit, because it's invested in all kinds of things which are...
Yeah, it went on that massive shopping spree, didn't it? Yeah.
At Felda global level as well as at FIC level. So there's been a lot of plundering of the organization, for want of a better word, since then. And he's been brought in to stem the bleeding, essentially. I just want to ask him whether he's the right man for the job, because ultimately he is a UMNO politician, and this is a avowedly UMNO organization.
Well, he was formerly the head of the UMNO Backbenchers Club.
That's right.
So, yeah, I mean, this, again, from a politician to head a government agency, would it not be better served headed by a bureaucrat or a technocrat,
correct,
for instance.
Correct.
Yeah, really interesting. I think that deviation from Felda's original mandate is something that I would be really interested in finding out more from. So I'd be keen to hear from the man himself on The Breakfast Grill at 8 o'clock. Now, as always, you can join in the conversation. We will have our lines open. You can WhatsApp us at 016-201-9000, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be open to hearing your thoughts and comments about the issue of Felda recently. Quite timely to have him on the grill, and I look forward to that. On Current Affairs today at 8:35, after The Breakfast Grill, we will continue our conversation from yesterday about US President Donald Trump's executive ban on immigration. And yes, the ban has been suspended by US courts, but, you know, Chuang, there are still lots of people who are concerned that it could further embolden terrorists. Essentially, you're playing into what, say, Islamic State has been radicalizing their believers.
Yeah, so you're going to ruffle the feathers even more, and you're going to irk them even more. And, violence doesn't beget violence. You know, violence begets violence, mm-hmm. and aggression begets aggression. I'm not sure whether Donald Trump's approach has always been conducive to peaceful relations. And certainly the remarks he's being made and the interpretations of his actions, sometimes beggar belief. So I can fully understand why some people might think it might embolden terrorism and IS a little bit more.
So we spoke to Professor Ahmad Fauzi Abdul Hamid, a political science professor at University Science Malaysia, to discuss how this might happen. Make sure you tune for that. Stay tuned for that at 8:35 a.m. on Current Affairs today. If you miss it, you can download the podcast on our app. You can find that. It's a brand new BFM app available on Apple's App Store and at Google Play. On the S&M show at 9:35 a.m, I miss the sound of whips on the show. Look forward to it every Wednesday. The S&M show, Jeremy Figgins will be joining us on the show. He is the author of King of Coal, a Jem Putanto novel. Essentially, what this is about is it's a fictional account of a truck driver in Indonesia. But one of the things it highlights is the way business is done in Indonesia. So it what Jeremy Figgins will like to discuss today is the pitfalls of investing in Indonesia, but also the potential of investing in Southeast Asia's biggest market.
Yeah, so I think the underlying tones here are of governance and the huge possibilities and the huge upsides of investing in essentially frontier and emerging markets. But the corollary of that and the opposite of that, which is basically corruption, because more often than not, resource investing involves G2G relations and huge tracts of land, essentially. And we've seen this with FGV and, you know, buying 37% of Eagle High. These are national assets.
So at Felder, not
correct.
At Felder, not FGV.
Mm-hmm. Initially, FGV, correct, and now Felder.
Right.
So yeah, quite rightly pointing out. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that I think Nat Rothschild, he's one of the, obviously, of the Rothschild family. Mm-hmm. He invested in Indonesia. I think the company's called Bumi, PT Bumi, and he lost a wad of cash. And that's exactly what it's all about, because huge upsides, but also equally huge downsides.
Yeah. No, and the question is whether, you know, this element of corruption adds a risk premium to investing in emerging markets, right? But, you know, how do you weigh that? That there's so much potential to be investing in emerging markets. Indonesia is one of the shining stars in this region. So, you know, to I guess, question the way business is done, the transparency of governance is, you know, perhaps adding a layer of premium to investing there.
Absolutely. And it's not just Southeast Asia, because when you look at it, we've got companies in Malaysia that are investing in emerging European countries like Kazakhstan, right?
That's
huge oil and gas.
But do you think that the resource industry is more susceptible to corruption?
Yeah, because they're national assets. Essentially, governments would have, you know, rights over them, right?
Right.
And you know, you they don't get carved out to private sector interests unless you're a Russian oil billionaire. But that's how, you know, that's how huge money is made. You know?
And just a note, since we're talking about Indonesia, one thing to watch out today is the fact that Jakarta will head to the polls to pick a new governor. Of course, this is mired in controversy with the incumbent Ahok. You know, of course, the controversy.
Chinese fellow, is it?
He's an ethnic Chinese Christian.
Is that right?
Yeah.
No way. Ahok.
His name is Cahaya Purnama, if I'm not mistaken. And he is incumbent and in the running for the governor again, his second term in Jakarta. And this is an important one, Chuang, because again, this is seen as a stepping stone to the presidential seat. Jokowi was formerly the Jakarta
and he
governor.
Didn't want to recontest his Jakarta position, did
exactly,
he?
Exactly, yes. Basuki Cahayapurnama, also known as Ahok, and he's facing, I guess, trial of insulting Islam in a speech last year. And all this has been marked by a series of protests by hardline group. We've seen some fake news come out as well. So much so that the Mufti Council of the Fatwa Council of Indonesia had to release a fatwa to say that fake news is haram. And we've also seen, you know, not just mass protests, but also Islamic State make a couple of threats, given that there are 7.2 million registered voters in Jakarta going to participate in this elections.
Well, not a drop in the park, not a drop in the pond, but yeah, it is huge, because if he does get through and he gets voted in, tremendous repercussions and obviously lots of big
I would
bets
say
would
that
be...
if he didn't get voted in, that would be even more, I guess, a sign of increasing religious intolerance, right? So this is an incumbent who is a minority ethnic Chinese, minority religious Christian, and he, you know, it has been at the end of, receiving end of a lot of criticism. It's really going to be an interesting fight. We'll have to see. The polls are showing that he's leading, though, but it could be a slim win. That's happening later today in Jakarta. We're going to keep an eye on that. But also around the world, overnight, John, there was news that that according to police, the estranged half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has allegedly been killed at KLIA.
When I saw that, I thought, my goodness, this is another item of fake news, because it was doing the rounds on WhatsApp.
I had to check.
I thought KLIA is another silly joke.
Crazy.
And it's true. Apparently, it's true. Although the police have denied the identity of the dead person, everybody seems to reckon it is the really, you know, Kim Jong-un's brother from a different mother, because it is his brother.
It literally is a brother of a different mother, yeah. So he is the older half-brother of Kim Jong-un. He was from different mothers. So his mother was the married actress Song Hae-rim, who was a consort of Kim Jong-il. Now, really quite interesting, just to come back to what happened. So he was said to be holding a passport in a different name at the time. So Kim Jong-nam was holding a passport in the name of Kim Cho. And there have been some conflicting reports, Chong. So a woman, an eyewitness, had reportedly said that there was a woman who approached Kim Jong-nam at the KLIA departure lounge and had covered his head with a cloth which contained an unidentified liquid. And after that, his eyes started to burn. And he went to the KLIA counter and was then sent to the Putrajaya Hospital, but he died en route to
incredible.
The hospital.
I saw that. It's incredible.
Yeah. There were other eyewitness accounts who said it wasn't a cloth. It was a splash of liquid. There was also some reports that said it was a syringe of with liquid. So who knows? I mean, what kind of... that sounds like it's straight out
of
a
movies.
Movie.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, the thing is, there has been a bit of a purge of people who have voiced out against him, Kim Jong-un, namely. Because, you see, Kim Jong-un's brother from a different mother, Jong-nam, was believed to be as close to his uncle, an individual named Jang Song-taek, who was North Korea's number two most powerful man before being executed on Kim Jong-un's orders in 2003. So...
yeah.
You know what I mean?
And
talk about
his,
consolidating power.
His execution was not made known until years after. So,
incredible,
yeah,
right?
Can you imagine that? It really, I mean, Kim Jong-nam, the deceased, was known to have spent a lot of time outside the country and had spoken out publicly against his family's control of North Korea. But what's interesting, Chuang, again, is that Bukit Aman, now this is as quoted by Oriental Daily, Bukit Aman said, at present, there is no indication that Kim Jong-nam was murdered. Police has classified the case as sudden death for now.
Yeah, I saw this also, this tweet from, I think, DPRK or something, which is, I think, the official, blaring loudspeaker of the...
of North the Korea. Republic of...
And it blames Malaysian food and says it's poisonous and...
Oh, did it?
Yeah, goodness.
So
he died of a food poisoning or something. And, you know, these Malaysians are dirty creatures. And I'm like, really?
Oh, I don't know what kind of food would cause stinging eyes.
Exactly.
Yeah, but
yeah.
Okay. So this is something we're watching. I was really surprised, taken aback by this, but it's making the front pages of almost all news websites, international news websites this morning, from the BBC to CNN to Wall Street Journal and CNBC. So I guess, you know, this is huge news. Malaysia dragged into...
yeah, incredible.
I think it's just a transit. He was on his way to Macau.
Is that right?
So he was here a couple of days and was about to leave the country to head to Macau.
He looks uncannily like his brother. The
really?
The same cherubic face and the same excellent
hairstyle.
The
father's genes are strong.
The father's genes. The fruit don't fall too far from the tree, shall we say.
Okay. In other news, Disney has cut ties with YouTube sensation Felix PewDiePie Kjellberg, after he incorporated anti-Semitic jokes and Nazi references into several of his videos. And this was after a Wall Street Journal review found that 9 of his videos posted over the last 6 months featured imagery of swastikas, Nazi salutes, and shots of Hitler.
Incredible. This guy, you know...
Are you a fan of him? He literally just plays video games and has millions
and does voiceovers
viewers. What is that?
The girls like him, I think, because he's not
bad to look at. He's easy on the eye.
He's easy on the eye, that's right.
I wouldn't click that video off, shall we say, if it popped up.
I don't watch it, lah. It's for young kids.
I mean, I have to say, of all the things that are available on YouTube, including that terrible video you directed me to about the pineapple.
Yeah.
Oh my lord. So I wouldn't click away from PewDiePie. But
he makes millions from his YouTube channel. Do you know that? Because they've got content sharing, content creation revenue sharing deals. He makes something like 10 to 15 million US dollars a year.
Well,
a year.
This is definitely going to hit his bottom line, because now Disney is dropping him after this. I was quite surprised when I read the headline that he lost the Disney deal. I wondered what had triggered it.
What kind of deal did he have with
Disney? He had that content sharing again. So
with Disney.
With Disney, yes, that's right. So really quite interesting to see just how much of his video, like how many videos he has that feature, you know, Nazis.
Must be in the
supporters.
Background or something. I mean, teenagers, right?
Well, he said that he's not serious in his use of that imagery. However, he was also in a clip, in a YouTube clip of a man dressed as Jesus Christ saying that Hitler did nothing wrong. He also paid two Indian men to hold up a banner reading "Death to all Jews." So clearly, that's not just lighthearted anymore. I mean, there's a serious, I guess, intention
overtone,
here. Yeah,
yeah,
an overtone here. So I guess we'll have to see how he reacts to that. How the 53 million subscribers, 53 million subscribers.
I bet you, Melissa, he's going to get even more subscribers now because he's been so controversial.
But I wonder, is he alt-right? You know, then is he, can he be categorized as a Nazi sympathizer? Who knows, right? So that's something. Essentially, maybe he might have to get a real job rather than play video games.
He's got 53.2 million subscribers.
Amazing. That is amazing.
More than the population of Malaysia, by the way. In fact, twice as much.
Sorry. All the people in Malaysia watching his YouTube
including
videos.
Including the Indonesians.
All right. 6:16 right now. More in just a few minutes right here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Shine a Light by the Rolling Stones. Good morning. It's coming up to 6:22 on Wednesday, the 15th of February. I'm Melissa Idris with Kusu Chuang this morning. And if you've ever gone to the Virgin Group website, you'll know that Richard Branson, the founder of Virgin Group, has a blog page, and he regularly updates their blogs with, you know, things that he finds insightful or tips for entrepreneurs. One of his blog posts include his top 30 documentaries, which he reckons he loves doing. So he loves sitting down watching good film, and every now and then he says he loves to pick documentaries. And he started out by saying his top 10 documentaries, and that got a lot of positive feedback, and he increased that list to his top 20, and now he's gone on to have his top 30 favorite documentaries.
Yeah, so people love Richard Branson because, you know, he's such a popular figure. He's down to earth, he's humble, he's successful, you know, and he does adventurous things, which I think is the main thing.
Do you reckon that he updates his own blog? I mean, it feels quite personal.
I think so. Even his autobiography, which I have and I've read several times,
right.
It sounds like him because, you know, he's not a particularly good writer, but he writes with a lot of passion.
Right, okay.
You know, but anyway, so he is actually, you know, quite interesting because he likes things like, you know, like number three on his list, when we were kings, and this is basically the Joe Frazier, George Foreman, Muhammad Ali era in the 70s and 80s, the golden era of boxing. And obviously that is a fantastic, it's available on YouTube, you can watch it. Then, you know, he also talks about this documentary called Don't Look Down, which is, you know, his ballooning adventures, fantastic. And then there's one on Senna, which is obviously the three-time world champion, Ayrton Senna. And he's biased because number one on this list is his son Sam's documentary on, I think, slavery or the war on drugs.
Yes, that's right. So that's called Breaking the Taboo. I didn't know his son was a filmmaker, and this was quite a nice surprise. Nice to see him show some fatherly affection.
Do you know what Richard Branson famously and controversially admitted one year during summer holidays when they were, I think, in Barbados or something? He smoked weed with his son, Sam. And,
yeah, he said that.
He said that he admitted it, and it was all over the Daily Mirror, the Daily Sun, and, you know, all the Daily Mail. And he was vilified in the press. I mean, he said, look, at the end of the day, if you want to stay, you know, close to your kids, you know, there are certain things that that will win their confidence. And and I think that every kid goes through that stage in their lives and they're experimenting.
Amazing.
And he did it, yeah.
Okay, quite, there you go. Different style of parenting to a lot of people.
That's right.
Different school of
thought. You can imagine the Asians would be like, are you mad or what?
That's true. I mean, I guess, you know, it's also a cultural difference there. But really, just coming back to documentaries, I have to say, I was really quite fascinated to look at the top 10 and I realized that I hadn't watched any of the top 10.
I've seen several of those,
you
actually.
Have? Yeah. I love documentaries. I really do.
I've seen your list, Melissa. You're very cerebral.
Okay, so when I came across this article and I had to think about, okay, which were my most favorite documentaries that I've watched? And I realized that in these past few years, because of access of streaming and video on demand, we've had a lot more access to documentaries that we wouldn't normally have had. Now, growing up, I would only, you know, that the only documentaries you would come across would be like Discovery Channel and History Channel and Nat Geo or what have you. It wouldn't be screening in the cinemas, or you wouldn't have access to it, just stream that entire movie on your computer. But now you can. And I was thinking about my favorites, and at the top of my list, and one that I've watched, I would have to say at least five times now, is Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Yeah.
Have you watched that one?
I've heard of it because Julian Ng loves, you know, he always recommends that documentary.
He recommended it to me.
Watching that documentary is like reading an Arundhati Roy novel. It's so tough going, it's so slow.
Really?
I tried several times to get past the 10th minute. Cannot lie.
Okay,
no
so
adventure.
It's a story of an 85-year-old man called Jiro Ono. He's considered...
No relation to Yoko, by the way.
No relation to Yoko. He is in Japan. He's considered to be the world's greatest sushi chef. And he is a proprietor of Sukiyabashi Jiro, which is this tiny little hole in the wall sushi place. It is the only Michelin star restaurant to not have a toilet, be in an underground subway, and it only seats 10 and only serves sushi.
Yeah.
And you can't even order. He just puts whatever he cooks in front of you.
It's quite uncanny because I've been to similar restaurants in Tokyo. For example, I went to Tokyo in 2002 and I visited a very old friend of mine, a tennis player named Khalil, actually a Malay guy living in Tokyo. Uncanny,
oh, wow.
Right? So he took me to Akira Kurosawa's house, family house on Embassy Road in Tokyo. Very expensive, but it's the old family house.
Okay.
A very high-end teppanyaki restaurant. Very small, very expensive. So he wanted, I think my friend wanted to show me how rich he was. Because he runs his tennis academies. So right. I'm telling you, I mean, and Tokyo is replete with stories like this because, I mean, and, you know, the teppanyaki was amazing, amazing.
Right. Well, what I loved about this and why I keep going back to it is it speaks to me because it's about work ethic. It's about doing something and doing it well for the rest of your life.
Correct.
Picking that
amazing
one thing and just go doing it over and over and over. And, you know, you would talk about putting in your 10,000 hours. This guy's going to put in a million hours of work.
Exactly.
I love that. I love that about the Japanese culture. And I want to instill that in myself. So sometimes when I watch the documentary, it's more of a reminder to myself that, look, someone can do this for his entire life.
Correct.
I mean, I remember one of the parts that has stayed with me over the years from watching this documentary is the fact that, you know, that simple egg sushi?
Yeah.
The very simple. The one, that little egg strip on top of the rice.
Yeah.
That's the simplest one. The apprentice spent 10 years making that. 2 years making that.
Is that right?
Over and over again.
Amazing.
Until Jiro said, yep, you're good enough to serve your egg sushi.
Amazing.
And I thought that was remarkable.
And we've got this, you know, this mentality in Malaysia, which is kind of like a bit tirapa and a bit touch
and
go.
Exactly. So you just do whatever. Also the kind of, and I can relate to this, that millennial mentality about, oh, I must do what I'm passionate about. If I don't like this little element of my job, then, you know, I must change it and find something that speaks to me.
It's so fleeting nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a bit like social media. You know,
but
you
with
just,
Jiro, slog and you do it over and over until you perfect it.
Correct. And he's
and
only got
remarkable.
Like 10 seats in this restaurant. Isn't it? Amazing.
There's like a 2 month waiting list.
And you don't do it for the money, clearly, right?
Clearly. That's one of my favorites. Another one I have to say, I like documentaries that change my mind about things. So Pandora's Promise was something that was really interesting to me. It's a 2013 documentary about the nuclear power debate. And like most documentaries, it's never neutral. It takes a position, right? So the central argument to this documentary was that nuclear power is essentially a victim of bad press.
Yeah.
And it is relatively safe. And it's a clean energy source, which can help mitigate global warming.
Yeah.
And I have to say that I went into that documentary with one perception and I came out of it with an open mind. And I love documentaries that can make me do that.
Correct. I agree with you. I mean, countries like Japan and France, I think they have something like 30% of their power needs coming from nuclear
energy.
But,
you know, we think about the nuclear disasters, the Fukushimas and the Chernobyls. So that's, for me, when I think nuclear, that is all I think about.
Yeah. But that's the thing, because when Malaysia had nuclear ambitions, you know, clearly there's a very strong strong and very effective and persuasive lobby for nuclear.
Mm.
But because of those two or three incidents, it's a bit like, you know, aviation disasters. Till today, Malaysia Airlines still suffers from the stigma.
Right.
But look at their safety record. It's amazing.
All right. Well, tell us what your favorite documentaries are. Hashtag tell BFM. Our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio. We've got Lynn Mark standing by with the first news bulletin of the day. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. She's waiting by Eric Clapton. Hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with Khoo Swee Chong and me, Melissa Idris, this morning, 6:40 on the clock. Now, Chong, yesterday we were speaking about the brand new end financing scheme by the One Malaysia People's Housing Programme, PRIMA, where as part of the scheme, house buyers just pay the monthly interest for the first 5 years. Now, the idea of this scheme was to increase home ownership among B40 and M40 of Malaysian households. It's the bottom 40 and the middle 40 of Malaysian households. So after discussing this, I remembered an article that I read in the New York Times, which really was surprising to me because it's quite similar to the situation in the US. Now, this is following a research paper from a couple of economists at Wharton Business School. And what they had said was that, what if people stopped thinking about their homes as an investment? Because the virtues of home ownership are so ingrained in the American psyche that often we forget that housing is also a source of economic stress. Rising milk prices are regarded as a household tragedy. You've got spiking gas prices stoking national outrage. But whenever home prices go up, everyone says that it's a recovery, even though it also means that this recovery means millions of people can no longer afford to buy homes.
Yeah, it's actually a very apt and very accurate analysis, because at the end of the day, when you analyze how governments operate and how central banks operate, they've got to make sure they've got a vibrant economy that is functioning and is, you know, appreciating in output every single year.
Mm.
And there is no single biggest multiplier to the economy than construction and property, which is why, for example, in Malaysia, we've got the PRIMA housing scheme, which kind of like foists the notion of ownership on people, because by doing so, you ensure the cyclical nature of home ownership and property and homes as a result. And, you know, the wheels of the economy keep turning around and around. The thing is, in the wake of the financial crisis from 2008 until today, it's starting to dawn on people such as yourself, Melissa,
mm-hmm.
that ownership ain't the holy grail it's supposed to be. Because, and I was criticized yesterday actually from my wife. She said that I sounded a bit arrogant in terms of telling people, you know, if you can't afford a home, don't buy it. But I was quite genuine about that analysis, because home ownership also means being married to your mortgage for 35 or 40
right.
years.
Right, that's a long-term commitment, yeah. My friend. Yeah.
And if the value of your house does not appreciate as it has, and people think that, you know, house prices appreciate and, you know, like night follows day and day follows night, it is not true.
That's true, yes.
That
so
is
I think
not
that
true.
Is the biggest misconception,
correct.
Right? That price, that you assume that your home value
will
keep going up.
It will not.
We regarded houses or homes as like a TV or a car or any other consumer good, people would then might expect home prices to go down instead of up. And what this means is that you'll have developers probably thinking about how to maximize their time and productivity with technology and design, as opposed to how to, you know, financing options or making sure that banks can give loans to their buyers. Politicians might start thinking about how they can lower home prices even further, because you see the same thing with gas prices. The minute petrol prices go up, there's a national outrage, and then you get the political will for politicians to do something.
Well, responsible governments don't put their people in prison for the rest of their lives, which is what a mortgage essentially is. Financial prison, because if you don't choose the right horse, you're sunk. But that's the thing. I mean, when you look at other countries around the world, for example, say Germany, right?
Mm-hmm.
Angela Merkel's government might be a little bit irresponsible in some other parts of this administration. But when it comes to home ownership and shelter for its people, it's got a renting culture. Not many Germans own
property.
Yeah, not many people in Germany own their own homes.
Ah.
In fact, they don't own their own cars. They don't own their own bicycles. And they basically are debt-free and they're happy, because what that means is that they can come and go as they please. They're not captivated by the system. And that's a very liberating feeling, because when you don't have to pay the bills, as it were, every month. And you just rent your bicycle, you rent your, you know, you take a cab from A to B, you take public transport. It's a very liberating experience.
Yeah, so again, coming back to the New York Times article about, you know, how the virtues of home ownership is so ingrained in our psyche.
It ain't necessarily
It's not just
so.
Here in Malaysia, it's not just here in Asian countries.
In America, it's the American dream, you own your own home.
But then in Germany, you're saying that psyche is slightly different.
Correct,
right?
Very different. I mean, in most of Scandinavia as well, young people don't own their own homes. They don't own their own cars. They take public transport. They walk everywhere.
Right.
And that's why they get to go and travel around the world for 2 years after they work in a bar for 6 weeks.
I have to say, I subscribe to that mentality where I would rather rent than own my own home. And it's one of the reasons is, you know, I often get caught up into thinking, well, how do I know that I want to be set as, you know,
correct,
in this one home for the next 30 years?
Absolutely.
Or how do I know I can sell it after, say, 10 years if I so
absolutely
choose to?
Absolutely.
And so I've been thinking about more and more about renting. And, you know, I find it difficult sometimes to have the conversation with, oh, you know what, you're mid-30s, you should be thinking about buying your own home. And it's hard. It gets hard for me to justify that to another generation, say, for instance.
Yeah, but you see what? Don't care. Don't care what people think. Because at the end of the day, if you're debt-free and you're liberated and you're free to come in and go as you please, don't care two hoots about what people
think. What happens when you're old and you have no place to live and, you know, I'm not making an income anymore and I have to pay my rent?
So I must admit, Melissa, I'm of that original school of thought where ownership is the main thing.
Right.
And you want to secure the shelter over your own head.
Correct.
So I'm still of the staple variety, but I can see how young people nowadays, there is no real proposition for them to buy a car, to buy a property, and for them to be free, it's above and beyond anything else that you know, that should be the consideration.
You know, I remember having this conversation with Julian.
Because freedom matters.
That's right, freedom
it
does
matter.
It
does.
But one way to get that freedom is to have financial freedom. And
correct,
I remember speaking to Julian Ng about this on Ringgit and Sense, and he said, well, one of the ways you can ensure that, you know, when you're old and you are you're worried about the roof over your head is to make sure that you have sufficient retirement savings. And this is where you start from now by saving and making sure that you're investing properly.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You want to have snowballs. You want to be starting snowballs when you're young. And that's why, you know, the Warren Buffett autobiography was actually called Snowball. So what you do when you're young, you build a lot of snowballs, or you form a lot of snowballs, whether it's a property investment, whether you're buying a blue chip stock, whether you're putting money aside in a unit trust, or whether it could be whatever asset class. And then in 30 or 40 years' time, because it's a time game, right,
mm-hmm,
investing, when you hit your 40s or 50s or whatever you want to cash in your chips, then you know, these snowballs would have rolled down the hill and they become, you know, big snowballs,
right?
And then you can cash those chips in and you can have an existence which involves a daiquiri on the beach. And but, bikinis.
Okay, but then this psyche, maybe not for you, Chong. Maybe you keep the bikinis
for some
at
other
home
people.
But, you know, when we talk about, you know, the psyche of home ownership, it's not just limited to the home, I've noticed. It's also it's also expanded to cars.
Correct.
We also have this, you know, car ownership psyche. And
correct,
this is a recent paradigm shift that I'm also going through. I'm questioning the necessity of a car right now.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, multiple cars in one household.
Much more than even property now, there is no real proposition to own your own car. I mean, look at KL, right? If you come to KL work, you can take an Uber everywhere, you can take a Grab everywhere, and tomorrow morning you're
going
to be
MRT,
LRT, mm-hmm, PRT, KRT, whatever, right? And you've got buses, trains, what? Tomorrow morning we talk to this company called Daygo, right? And they're trying to get two-wheel transport as well, which is a fantastic idea. They've got regulatory issues to address.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to own a car because the cost of ownership of a car is multifold, right?
Yeah.
You've got depreciation, you've got financing costs, you've got your maintenance, you've got your road tax, your insurance. It's six or seven levels of costs, right? If you don't want to own a car, today you don't have to.
And you see that some households, you know, have two, three cars in one household.
You see, I love cars. I buy a car because I love to drive.
You're an enthusiast.
Drive.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's different than just, you know, necessity, driving to work, driving to the shops, driving to school.
But when I go for meetings in town, I'll take an Uber.
Yeah, I do too. I leave my car at home and I leave it parked in the car because it's just a lot simpler to use a ride sharing app. Yeah. But you also came across an article in the Financial Times, a comment, an op-ed piece in the Financial Times about a woman who is struggling to buy a car and why buying a new car drove her somewhat mad.
Yeah, so from none other than just, you know, double barrel surname, Merrin Somerset Webb. She's a weekend, you know, personal finance columnist, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you must buy a car, there is a huge proposition to not have to buy new, because the premium you pay for new and the depreciation that you get on a new car, it's staggering. So, you know, the proposition to buy on lease, for example, or secondhand.
On lease meaning?
On lease. Okay, so for example, which is why a couple of years ago, you know, car sales went through the roof in Malaysia, because the advent of leasing services. What happens is you put on a small deposit on a car, and Mercedes do a fantastic job with it, you know, BMW do a fantastic job with it. You put a small deposit on a vehicle, you pay a leasing fee every month, it's kind of like an installment, and then after the expiry of, say, 2 years, you can actually trade in that car for an entirely new car, at no extra cost, right? Or you can put down a lump sum, it's called a balloon payment, and you can then own the car outright. So you've got options.
Right.
Granted, the monthly lease payment is a little bit higher than an installment, but you've got options. And they offer insurance, they offer, you know, highway services in case you break down. You know, you're protected.
Okay, okay. Yeah. So
it's a huge proposition to lease a car nowadays, but it's costly, right? Because you've got to keep the car in a certain good nick. And if you don't get beyond a certain mileage, then you start to pay per mile or pay per kilometer.
Okay, so that's one option, and that a lot of people clearly subscribe to that, given you know the
or you just buy secondhand, which is what I've been doing in my entire life.
So this is where I have questions about this. So you say, you know, buying a brand new car is not worth the premium that you buy for a brand spanking new car, but when you buy secondhand, Chong, especially here in the Malaysian market, how can you be assured that you're not getting conned or you know cheated out of a good quality car?
Yeah, you do things to mitigate the potential downsides, right? You know the car, you know the history, you know the model, you know what to look out for. You do your research on the internet.
You
go to YouTube.
Due diligence first.
You bring along a buddy who's a mechanic, and then you test drive it. And then you know, right now it's a buyer's market, so you are the one who is empowered, not the seller.
So have you ever bought a brand new car?
I have recently because I've got family and kids now. Okay. So I give them the safe car and I drive the old car.
Right. I have to say that the car ownership mentality is really quite fascinating because it's tied up with ego and again, the virtues of asset ownership, but it's a depreciating asset. And you know,
absolutely, unless you buy a Ferrari.
And I remember.
That's true. It's true. Some cars are going up in value. I'm serious.
One of the questions I remember getting on Ringgit and Sense, the personal finance show on BFM, was when is a good time to change your car? And you know that is a question that is on a lot of Malaysians' minds. When is a good time to change your car? Most people say, "Oh, the car is obsolete the minute you pay off the last payment on your on your car loan."
It's entirely a subjective issue because, I mean, a lot of people would say, oh, you know, my car's starting to break down. And, yeah, of course it would because it's, you know, 5 or 7, 8 or 8 years old.
Right.
And if you if you look after your car, it can last you a long time. You know what I mean? Because I drive a 25-year-old. Both my personal cars are 25 years old. I know a lawyer friend of mine who has a Beetle. He, you know, his Beetle has done 2.5 million miles.
Wow.
Right? And we drove up to Laos in it.
Wow!
Yeah,
it took you all the way.
Yeah, his car.
Did it kind of?
You know, his car is 49 years old this
amazing.
Year.
Amazing.
His dad bought it in 1967. He's the second owner because his father was the first. It's done 2.5 million miles. It's a Volkswagen Beetle. Fantastic, right?
Fantastic. That is great. I mean,
he don't want to buy any other car. That's his car. That's his daily car.
Okay, amazing. Yeah, but you know, you can't deny that a lot of people own cars they can't afford. Again, coming back to the affordable housing issue with Prima yesterday, an economist that I follow on Twitter tweeted to say that affordable means price relative to income,
absolutely.
Not price relative to loan repayment.
Absolutely.
So I thought that was quite clever.
Absolutely.
It's something to bear in mind when you're thinking about whether you can afford a house or whether you can afford your next new fancy red little sports car.
Yeah.
Okay, it's now 6:53. We've got news coming up at the top of the hour. And to take you there, I Feel Free by Cream on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.